This is absolutely essential to improve the state of the world there. We've come a long way since those initial banker contours. We had three busloads of bankers trooping around the South Central Vermont areas, looking at communities there, not just the burned out pulp that some people thought was all of that area, but also the nicely manicured lawns and obviously well cared for homes in that area as well. It opened my eyes, and I'm sure it opened the eyes of an awful lot of other people on those bus tours. Since that time, Operation Hope has gone off in a variety of different directions. The first direction was the creation of the Operation Hope Centers, which are effectively bank branches in the underserved areas of LA initially. This was an extraordinarily important step because these were areas that had been abandoned by an awful lot of financial institutions over the years. You could not find a bank branch easily at all in the South Central area in the early 90s. And as a regulator at the time, I was kind of appalled that none of the banks were stepping up to the plate. But here was this young entrepreneur. He's still a young entrepreneur, even 10 years later, who basically said, "We can do it. We will do it." And opened the first Operation Hope Center in South Central LA in partnership with some bank sponsors that he had corralled during these bus tours to help him out. That progressed into East LA, then Watts, another Operation Hope Center. We now have them in Long Beach, and most recently in Oakland, and very most recently in Washington, D.C., so it is a national coast-to-coast scope. These centers have developed, they've been more or less taken over pretty much by the banks, but Operation Hope got them off the ground and running. It was truly innovative, and they've made over $230 million in committed loans through those centers for both homeownership as well as small business loans. Second step was banking on our future. Banking on our future is a financial literacy effort to bring financial education into the schools. It involved, again, putting the arm on bankers and other financial services industry providers to help teach financial literacy programs in the schools, in the inner cities. And to date, Operation Hope has sponsored over 7,000 sessions, financial literacy sessions, and trained over 142,000 students in partnership with its banks through Banking on Our Future. And trust me, that's just the beginning of that effort. That's just up through last year. That effort is exploding around the country, not just in California, but in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C., in New York City, pretty much moving all across the country. Third, in the wake of the 9/11 disaster, John Bryan sat down and said, "Gosh, what can we do? What is needed here that's not being done?" And out of that thought came the Hope Coalition America, again a partnership between Operation Hope and a large number of financial institutions around the country to provide pre-disaster training and post-disaster assistance for people who need it the most and don't know where to turn in the event of a disaster, such as the one that hit New York City. That turned in, by the way, to an agreement with the Department of Homeland Security that Operation Hope signed last year, John?
Yeah, two agreements last year.
Two agreements to partner with the Department of Homeland Security in providing these services. The most recent piece of the Operation Hope efforts is now being termed the Civil Rights Movement. And I'm going to let John go into that for you. That was just kicked off this spring. In conjunction with Ambassador Andrew Young, and I think John will probably want to explain that a little bit more himself. You probably get the idea. John Bryant is a doer. He's a remarkable doer. He has accomplished things that other people have not been able to accomplish. And I'm extremely proud of the guy. I'm extremely proud to call him my friend as well, particularly since world leaders have recognized very well both the innovative nature of what he's done and the importance of that work. He's worked with both President Bush and President Clinton. He's taught Banking on the Future classes with Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan. He's been recognized by the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, as one of the 250 global young leaders that they've recognized to bring into that forum with ideas for the future. And that's kind of just the sample. I'm not talking about the publications that they've recognized and the many, many other honors he's received. That's just kind of hitting the high points. There is one thing, however, that I've learned about John. This is a very important life lesson. It's part of the Robinson rules, if you will, of public speaking. And that is always precede him to the podium. Never follow him to the podium. Because it would be nothing but embarrassing. So it is my honor and pleasure to be able to introduce to you John Bryant as our keynote speaker. My friend.
John Robinson, a national board member that actually reads all of his emails.
No, I don't.
I mean, you are statistically up to date on all that we are doing. And Jeff is tight. I mean, Jeff's got a time schedule up here on the podium, just in case you get confused about when you want him to stop. First and foremost, let me just say, I think you guys are extraordinarily blessed to have a leader like Jeff. The Bible says when there is no vision, the people perish. And as I was talking to John Robinson earlier this morning, you don't do business with governments, you don't do business with companies, you do business with people. And I have a pretty good sense of people. It's been said that a friend you meet was a friend from the very first time. But an acquaintance you meet remains an acquaintance for a lifetime. There are people you meet and you're just comfortable with them. And the day you shake their hand, Jeff's one of those people. And again, I just commend you for your vision and your tenaciousness. We told Jeff no 4 or 5 times. My office said, John just can't make it. He's passing himself in airports. And Jeff obviously believes in the John Bryant formula for success, which is success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. So I thank you so much. And Jeff also and his team works overtime. If there's somebody in charge of the mic, you can lower it down a bit. As you can tell from my voice, it doesn't need much help. Jeff obviously is a social entrepreneur in the sense that an entrepreneur works 18 hours a day to keep him getting a job. So he's working overtime. Now, this is some good stuff I'm giving you. I know it's early, but, get with it. John Robinson is an extraordinarily special person to me. John Robinson is a former regulator with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, where he was deputy comptroller, which means he's big baller, shot caller. That's black, I'll translate it for you later. John Robinson, before that, was a regional director for the Office of Risk Division. And John Robinson was the first regulator to stand up in South Central LA after the riots and say, shame on the banking and financial services industry. Thank you very much. Shame on you for not acting on your platitudes and false promises. And without knowing me and, knowing the conservative nature of regulators without knowing me, this is extraordinary. He stepped out on faith and said, here's a guy who's doing something. I was then 26 years young. It was actually 13 years ago. And he chastised the industry at a public forum and said, essentially, PhDs are good, but PhDs are better. And here's a group that's doing something, and you should try to follow their lead. And I'll forever be indebted to you for stepping out early when it wasn't popular to be a support base for us. You cannot have a rainbow without a storm first, so I just want you to know your rainbow's coming. And John is so cool, we've actually made him an honorary black man. So you can he's turning away. We're gonna have a conversation. I'm going to talk and hopefully adhere to the AME Church doctrine of public speaking, which is be good, be quick, and then be gone. But if I go too passionately, give me the 3 to 5 minute mark, and I will probably shut up. I would like to stop talking enough in advance to get a few questions going in the audience. I think it's an intimate enough crowd. Sometimes the groups I talk to, you don't have a chance to do this, the first they have a dialogue. I'm also recording this in case you want to get it later. You can go on the website at johnhoebryan.com and you'll actually be able to download and listen to the remarks. The riots of 1992. Before I say anything else, the first thing you need to understand about me is that I'm a businessman. That I come from the business and the private sector. And so I have a completely different kind of perspective and orientation. I don't run a nonprofit, I founded a nonprofit. And there is a difference in the perspective. When I was 10 years old, I started my first business. It was a neighborhood candy house in Compton, California. Bummed 40 bucks off my mother, bought candy at the Iris food store, ate through half the inventory, ate candy to this day, sold the other half. Made $300 a week, found girls, lost a business, been a recurring theme of my life, but at a very young age, I learned that you can do anything in this world if you had a vision for yourself and if you willed it. I was a 10-year-old in Compton, California. There's a relevance to this story because the key in my life, beyond God, was my mother and my father. My mother told me she loved me every day of my life. A very powerful message to be told by a mother that their child is loved. So I never really had much of a self-esteem problem. Thus the quote, there's a difference between being broke and being poor. Being broke is an economic condition, but being poor is a disabling frame of mind and a depressed condition of your spirit, and you must vow never, ever, ever to be poor again. One of my friends who's very rich in spirit is Betty Atkinson, who's here from the EDA, who's another one of our partners. Thanks for being here. Please give Lynn Smith my best. If you extrapolate this message to the state of what I would call inner cities in Europe, they call them the suburbs, where poor people live, where the immigrant population lives, the low-wealth population. And we can't just say minorities because there's more poor whites murdered than poor anybody else in this country. How do you say the Appalachians? But if you want to extend this, let's say traditionally to an inner city, you could say this about every inner city in America. If I don't like me, I'm not going to like you. If I don't feel good about me, I'm not going to feel good about you. If I don't respect me, I'm not going to respect you. If I don't love me, I can't love you. I don't even know what love looks like. And here's the big one. And here's the reason why you should do what you're doing from a moral and a societal perspective. If I don't have a purpose in my life, I'm going to make your life a living hell. Any society is at its greatest risk by those who have no stake in it. Want to solve terrorism? Actually, pretty easy. Solve poverty. Back to my mom and my dad. My dad is 79 years young, little Parkinson's in his right arm.
Until you don't feel sorry for him. He believes in a hand-up philosophy, not a hand-out philosophy. He actually believes in the James Brown version of affirmative action. Open the door, I'll get it myself. My dad has owned a business for 53 years. So when people ask me, John, how did you get your mind around starting a business at 10 years of age? My response was, it never dawned on me that I couldn't. Because I saw my father do it. Keep this in mind as I tell you the rest of the story. So now let's fast forward to the riots of 1992. I've already said I'm a businessman and I come from everything from a different perspective. I even come from politics from a different perspective. We are the only nonprofit in history to host two U.S. presidents in 1 week. We hosted our first black president, President Clinton, in Harlem on April 24th, 2002, and partnered with him to educate every child in Harlem in financial literacy. The same week, we rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange on the 10th anniversary of Operation Hope, and then we hosted President George W. Bush in South Central LA on April 29th, on the 10th anniversary of the worst riot in U.S. history. Now, no one said anything critical about President Clinton. And revisionist history says, kumbaya, we are the world, he's an amazing president, we love him. When he was in office, we kicked his rear end. That's a whole nother issue. But with President Bush, of course he will complain that I hosted a Republican president. And to that I have this to say. Number one, last time I checked, he's the president. I'll let that sit with you for a moment. There's not 12 of them, there's not 6 of them, there's not 3 of them, there's 1 of them. And if you're smart, you should be talking to him. And if he wants to visit your community, your only question should be, what time? Let me get to the heart of the matter. What I said is this, my community is in a crisis. So I don't really care whether you're black or white, rich or poor, conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrat, if you want to help me eradicate poverty in my community, you are my friend. And if you don't, you're just wasting my time. I'm not a member of the Republican Party. I'm not a member of the Democratic Party. I'm a member of the Get It Done Party. And we need to be about getting it done. Because our communities are in trouble. Society is in trouble. But there's hope. The riots of 1992. As the worst riot in U.S. history was smoldering through South Central L.A., 3,000 structures damaged, 55 people lost their lives, 8,000 people were arrested. People were protesting and talking about what I call spilled milk. You can't unspill milk. Talking about the effect and not dealing with the root causes. Again, I'm a businessman, so while people are running around, I said, I'm not a community leader, I'm not a political leader, don't want to be one, I'm not a religious leader, I'm not that good. What can I do? I'm just a businessman. My pastor said, take your business skills and put them to use. All of these folks walking around here, politicians and such, cannot altogether rebuild this community because they're not capitalists, they're not bankers, they're not business people. And then we looked at some statistics and I found a shocking one. 3,000 structures damaged, $1 billion in property damage, and guess how many of the structures were homes? I'm sorry, I heard somebody say something very strange and unorthodox and I'd say just ridiculous in the back. I'll repeat this. 3,000 structures were damaged, $1 billion in property damage. It wasn't like a coordinated situation where they said, you get that one, I'll get this one. You know, folks were rioting. How many were homes? I mean, come on, you're intelligent people. Not a one. You don't burn that which is your own. It's not a black issue, it's not a brown issue, it's not a white issue, it's a green issue. It's a human issue. It's called enlightened self-interest. 3,000 structures and not one was a home. Now let's go a little further into the statistics. 35% of residents in 1992 in South Central LA owned their own home. 35% of the residents. in South Central Lake own their own home. 65% rented for the same cost of a mortgage payment. Now, wouldn't you, given an informed choice, prefer to be a homeowner than a renter? I mean, this is kind of basic. If you can afford to own a home, it has to be low self-esteem, lack of access, a lack of information, and a lack of tools. But let's go one step further. 35% of the residents own their own home. Guess what the voter turnout rate was in South Central LA in 1992? 38%. You don't need my friend Jesse Jackson to do a voter turnout drive. You don't need protests. You don't need folks picketing up and down the streets. You don't need emotionalism. You need more homeowners. And my mother was a homeowner. My mother used to always say, "You better get off of my porch with that mess, underline my." She didn't say get off my black porch. She said get off of my porch, even if you're black. Now,
you can laugh, by the way.
Now, 35% of the residents were homeowners. And what happens when you create a homeowner? You create a homeowner, you create a venture capitalist. With equity in their home, to send their child to college, to start a business when the bank, not Washington Mutual, might discriminate against you. Cover your bases. I ain't fool. When you want to live your dreams, you need a place to anchor those dreams. And make no mistake about it, this is a democracy rooted in capitalism. This place called America. I will get to that in a moment. I remember I was in Amman, Jordan last week, and Sharon Perez walked up to me, and I walked up to him from Israel. I shook his hands. I'm so honored to meet you, sir. He said, "I know your work. You do good work." And we start talking, and he says, we start talking about socialism and things in the world. He says, even if you want a lot of socialism, first you got to be a good capitalist. So, even socialism requires capitalism. And so understand that this is a country that is a democracy rooted in capitalism. So when you create a homeowner, you create a venture capitalist. When you create a homeowner, you create a policeman on that block. When you create a homeowner, you create a voter. More concerned about the school board president and the city councilman than who's the president of the United States of America. When you create a homeowner, you create enlightened self-interest. When you create a homeowner, you create a taxpayer. People talk about tax breaks. You don't care about tax break unless you've got a job. You don't understand infrastructure repairs and bond issuance unless you are a homeowner or a small business owner. It's about enlightened self-interest. And so this issue, let's now deal with the issue of home ownership for a second in a broader context. Every nation goes through four economic models. They go through the agricultural age, the industrial age, technology age, and the information age. You start with a home in the agricultural age, and it is the one thing that sees through all four models. Where are we today in the information age? What's the king asset today? Education. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. And so here's the civil rights that I'm suggesting is really the main and broader issue that you're going to be tackling here in Seattle. If the 20th century was about erasing the color line all over the world, are what we call civil rights, from South Africa to the southern states in America, to the caste system in India, to the mestizo and the Spaniard in Mexico, to even places like Japan, where the dark Japanese are working in the prefectures as farmers, and the light Japanese are running the country. The 20th century was primarily issues led by race and the color line, all over the world, of what we call civil rights. And if the first civil right was the right to vote, with others to follow, then I'm going to suggest to you that the 21st century, an economic era, it's going to be led by issues of class and poverty. Class and poverty. And if that's true, what I call the silver rights era And the first silver right is financial literacy. Because if you don't know better, you cannot do better. 70% of this country's population, according to the Wall Street Journal, March 2004, are living from paycheck to paycheck. Now, they didn't say 70% of black folks or brown folks. They said 70% of everybody. Let me bring this home to your front doorstep. If you're living in California or New York and making less than $50,000 a year, you're living in Seattle, Washington, let me be charitable and say making less than $35,000 a year, you are struggling just to make ends meet. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
All right, the church of what's happening now, what have you done for me lately? So, according to the Federal Reserve, 80% of our economic activity every year is on the back of the U.S. consumer. That's you and me buying coffee, coming to breakfast, getting in your car, buying gas, paying for your lease payments, paying for your mortgage payments, is consumer spending. I'll come back to this shocking statistic in just a moment. So the first silver right is financial literacy. If you don't know better, you can't do better. Then isn't home ownership a silver right? And maybe small business ownership should be a silver right, seeing as only 70% of all Americans are employed by a small business. And maybe health and wellness should be a silver right, because how do you get up and go to a job if you don't have your basic health? And maybe self-esteem and what I call spiritual wealth is a silver right. We're not human beings having a spiritual experience, we're spiritual beings having a human experience. If I don't like me, I can't like you. And then you can go on and create an entire list of silver rights appropriate for the 21st century. And if that's true, then what we have on our hands, ladies and gentlemen, is a movement. The first movement since the civil rights movement 40 years ago, we might call that our wilderness period. Let me frame the issue a little further. Are you with me so far?
Yes.
I'm not boring you, am I? But I've got low self-esteem. I need you with me. So let me go back a minute. And let me get a little sensitive. I was looking at some statistics for Seattle. And the Seattle of 1960 is not the Seattle of 2005. You got less nuclear families. You've got more immigrants. You've got more single households, which is putting pressure to create more affordable housing. You've got what some people might call an immigrant problem. I'm fascinated when people talk about an immigrant problem. Let me see if I can put this in a little context for you. Because I really think you've got an immigrant opportunity. You see, if you're from Europe, Europe wants an immigrant. There was never anybody in the United States of America except an Indian, and he got his rear end whipped. We're all guests. Your forefathers came to this country and decided to make a way out of no way and done an extraordinary job. In 1901, there was no mortgage loan, there was no line of credit, there were no credit cards, there were no equity enhancement loans. There were only commercial credits. And the best loan in 1901 was a loan secured by inventory. What's the worst loan in 2005? A loan secured by inventory. If you said you wanted a mortgage in 1910, somebody would lock you up. Bank of America, I know they're here. They started because they're the Bank of Italy. And had the nerve to loan to immigrants after the fires and the ravages of San Francisco, small loans. And people said they were crazy. What am I suggesting to you? That this is nothing more than the democratization of credit. Let me go one step further and suggest, what am I suggesting to you? And that these new immigrants are nothing more than the most recent individuals to participate in the democratization of credit. Let me go one step further and say something really crazy. That diversity is a business trick. Don't hire anybody, don't lend anybody, don't do anything because you want to help black people, brown people, or poor people. It is not a sustainable strategy. I'm talking about enlightened self-interest. I already told you, I'm a businessman. So let me now make a business argument. The Civil War was not about saving my black rear end.
Now, I'm sure that some folks said, you know, it's really unfortunate. You know, we gotta hook these black folks up because they gonna, you know, tear this place up. We gotta do something. You know, set them free. But by the way, get me my ownership first. You know what the Civil War is about? The South resisting Northern economic domination. The South was in an agricultural age. How do you say free labor? You'll get that later. And the North, this is some of my best stuff, and I mean, it's just flat. I mean, it's the North was going into the industrial age, import, export, demand, benefiting from diversity. Guess what kind of diversity? Your forefathers showed up at the equivalent of an Ellis Island, looked north and saw diversity and industry and export and finance and all kind of growing economy. Looked south and saw blacks catching heads, said, I'm not black, but my test is my luck, and headed north. And the Civil War was about the South resisting Northern economic domination. That's what it was all about. Economics and ownership. Let's fast forward now to the Civil Rights Movement. And I know you got a black population here. It is growing, but it is smaller than most states. Let me use this as a bellwether. After the Civil War, you had something called 40 Acres and a Mule. Some of you might be familiar with this. When Lincoln was assassinated, the general reversed the order. I think it was a devastating move. Because what happened was, blacks were told to have a work ethic, but not given a good reason. Wait a minute, I'm going to work, but I'm not going to get the benefit of my labor. I don't think so. A sharecropper meant you never got to own that which you worked for. By the way, none of this is personal. This is all fact-based. So, somebody took on their hands out of righteous indignation, as you would, for being forced to work without receiving any benefit. But unfortunately, after three generations of doing that, you're now sitting on your hands, but you don't really know why. You're just sitting on your hands. So now you fast forward to, let's say the 60s. I'm sorry, the 40s. After World War II, we had the birth of the middle class, the black middle class. It was called government jobs. Because that's where you got a level playing field. Teachers, librarians, I'm sure you get the point. But because we didn't have a baseline in economics, we assumed that a middle class was a nice wardrobe, a leased car, and a rented apartment building. We weren't dumb and we weren't stupid. It's what we didn't know that was killing us. There's an old Southern saying, no matter how much I love you, my son or my daughter, if I don't have wisdom, I can only give you my own ignorance. And so out of love, we pass down bad habits from generation to generation. To rationalize this here, rational lies. We're not dumb, we're not stupid, it's what we didn't know that was killing us. So what was the first power we got? It was political power in the 60s. We're the only modern race of people that created a political power base before we created an economic one. Now that's devastating in a capitalist country. And if you look at our politics, it's all about protecting subsidies and entitlements. It makes perfect sense because that's the orientation. But we need a new orientation. And so now let's bring us into the 21st century. The largest economy in the world is what? Let me help you, it is. I know it's early. Work with me. It's the United States of America. It happens to be the only place in the world where every race of people is within our borders. Good morning. We've got the two largest economies in the United States. California and New York. We're the two most ethnically diverse places in the United States. You cannot do business with people you don't reflect, respect, or understand. That's why the world comes to the U.S. That's why we can do business with the world, because we reflect the world. Diversity is not a threat. It is a business asset. You want to find an economy flat? Find an economy that's got one black, one Indian, and one Latino, and nobody else. Because it can relate. It's not personal. It's business. You don't do business with companies. You do business with people. So now let me bring this home. In 92, I had a crazy idea called Operation Hope, and we want to eradicate poverty. Everybody told us we were wasting our time and wrote me off, and thank God they did that. I had to put $200,000 of my own money in this nonprofit because nobody else would believe in it. We had a $61,000 budget, one employee, and a vision to change the world and to eradicate poverty. The AR budget is $8 million. 80% funded. Thank you. 80% funded by the private sector. This is our 13th year. We've lost over 13 years, six partners out of 250 partners with $4.3 trillion in assets between them. Citigroup, who doesn't join anybody, they don't like their logo next to somebody else. I asked them for $1 million in 2002 and volunteers to teach financial literacy. They gave me $25,000 and eight volunteers at Harvard. The next year I asked them for $1 million and a bunch of volunteers. They gave me $250,000 and 300 volunteers in New York. The next year, we asked them for $1 million. You'll get the hint. And that year, they invested, not gave us, $500,000 and 1,000 volunteers. And we're now a national partner with Citigroup. And so the Operation Hope is about government, community, and the private sector working in partnership, because you can't eradicate poverty on your own, number one. It has to be bipartisan, but you can't do it on partisan lines. It doesn't even make any sense to talk about doing it on partisan lines. That's personal. That's about you. That's not about the people. And then it's about conversion, converting a check-cashing customer into a banking customer, moving them up and out of poverty. So I hate check cashers. I'm on record as saying I think it's a morally repressive business. Every customer you educate is every customer you lose. We bought a check casher. We figured if you couldn't beat them, buy it. So we partnered with Union Bank of California and partnered to buy half interest in the largest check casher in South Central Los Angeles. 600,000 customers per month in South Central Los Angeles. Many locations across the street from a bank. So you can't say it was market prices that was the issue. There are a number of issues that complicate why somebody goes to a check casher. If you're from Mexico, you believe the Bank of America is the Bank of America. Okay, this is really tough. And so people criticized me when we did this, but Jesus Christ didn't judge you. He went where you were and said, let's go from here. A saint is a sinner that got up. And so we went and partnered, because there were 600,000 people who were check cashing customers who could be banking customers. Fast forward to 2004, Union Bank opened 40,000 accounts in six states, deposit accounts. We opened 4,000 accounts in mixed check cashing in South Central LA, or 10% of their entire new deposit business comes from us, converting a check cashing customer into a banking customer and moving them up and out of poverty. We do it with the power of financial literacy. And then you can fast forward to converting a renter into a homeowner, and a small business dreamer into a small business owner, and a minimum wage worker into a living wage worker with a new job skills, and the economically uneducated to the economically empowered. We opened these hope centers that John talked about, which is a kind of a cross between a bank branch and a Kinko's for empowerment. One-stop shopping for changing your life. And when you walk in the front door, there's a sign on the wall that says, no loans denied. Very powerful. Because people are more poor than they are broke. And so the first thing you do is give them their dignity back. Make no mistake about it, ladies and gentlemen. The civil rights movement was not about the right for a white guy to sit next to a black guy at a lunch counter, or vice versa. It was a campaign for respect and dignity. And the civil rights movement is a campaign for respect and dignity. The only difference is now it's not your respect of me, it's my respect of me. And so when you don't want to walk in the bank branch because you believe you're going to be declined. And so the wall says no loans denied. This is the value that the nonprofit sector brings, because unlike a bank that must approve you or decline you by law, a nonprofit can say maybe. So we approve you day one, subject to the resolution of your primary denial factors. Then we bring you in, we sit you down, with your permission, we pull your credit report. Ooh, baby! Okay, we start laughing. Looks like a bus accident, but okay. We approve you, but you need credit counseling, case management, a little financial CPR. You need dollar-for-dollar matching grants because you have a down payment issue. Because you're living from paycheck to paycheck. You have these, like a doctor, I'm going to prescribe a solution, and I'm going to back you into an approval.
And once you resolve these primary denial factors, I'm going to boost your FICO score 100 points, which is what we do on average over 18 months. And by the time we finish with you, you're going to be low-hanging fruit for every bank in town. So when we finish with you, you have thick file underwriting, copies of utility bills, copies of rent statements, copies of phone bills. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, all forms of credit. You're paying your rent on time, it's a form of credit. You're paying a car insurance premium, and you don't pay it one time a year, you pay it monthly. I hate to break this to you, but that's a loan. Because the insurance company is not in the lending business. Guess what they've done? They have securitized that paper, bundled it, and sold it into the secondary market, and are servicing that paper on behalf of the lender. And when you put it, when you send in your $40 a month for your car insurance, all right, that's a form of credit. Your light bill, your phone bill, all forms of credit. Your utilities, all forms of credit that don't show up on your electronic credit report. So we do thick file underwriting. We also do dollar for dollar matching grants. For every dollar you put in a new savings account at Washington Mutual, or at Bank of America, or wherever. Manny Mays have a bank yet. Sure, it's coming. For every dollar you put up, we'll grant you a dollar up to $5,000 as long as you buy a home in a low-wealth area. The money is yours. We've done $20 million of those deals with a $500,000 fund, which is not a lot of money. What you're doing is getting somebody to believe that home ownership is indeed possible if they do the work. So at the end of the day, you boosted the FICO score, you have thick file underwriting, you got dollar for dollar matching grants, you're giving them the power of self-esteem. They must show up every week on time with their receipts because they must have the dignity of having self-discipline. It's about a hand up and not a handout. And 18 months later, every lender is tripping over themselves to fund that loan. It's not a black homeowner, it's not a brown homeowner, it's a good homeowner. And in 11 years of lending, $140 million in funded home loans, not one home loan has ever gone bad. In 2002, we became the first nonprofit in history to build a bank branch and sell it to a bank. You know, when you go in the communities where you and I live in, and notice I said you and I, because it's a class issue, not a race issue, you don't really care, by the way, if I'm your neighbor, as long as I don't barbecue on your lawn. I mean, it's really, you know, as long as I do what a neighbor does in our class environment, you're cool with having me as your neighbor, is that right? Well, maybe not me, but I mean somebody like me. What I say is, when you go to a lower community, you don't want a Hope Center. You want a bank branch, like everybody else. But in the meantime, sometimes you have to do what I call private banking for the working class. All of the soft banking services that bridges the gap between being bankable and near bankable. You know, there's a lot of money left on the table in inner city America, ladies and gentlemen. There's a lot of money. Beyond the moral issue, this is called an emerging market. CRA must move from a compliance issue to a new markets issue, and ultimately at Washington Mutual and every other bank, there should become ultimately not a CRA officer, but there should be a AVP, a VP, an EVP, and a vice chairman of emerging markets. This has to be about ultimately a new line of business. And let me give you a shocking statistic. 75% of all children today under the age of 10 in America are ethnic minority children. Sit with that for a minute. That means in 10 years, ladies and gentlemen, that's your customer. It doesn't matter whether you are, you know, into diversity, or you want to join hands and sing Kumbaya, or whether you like black people or brown people. It's okay if you don't like me. I like me. The point is, this is about the future of your business. And don't you want to be prosperous and profitable? If you do, you will have to learn how to embrace people who are a little different from you. I'm not talking about bad lending or risky lending. I'm talking about non-traditional lending, because we're living in a new world. And so now these Hope Centers, we sold them for over $1 million to three banks, who then replaced us, and we provided soft banking services next to the bank providing hard banking services in each one of those locations. One in the Latino area, because 3% of our clients are Hispanic and Spanish-speaking, one in a black area and one in a black-brown area. Those bank branches are now exceeding deposit and lending and fee income ratios for a traditional branch in any marketplace, and not just in an emerging market, an emerging market marketplace. You can do well and do good. You can do well by doing good. And let me give the banker a little additional motivation. Nobody's gonna give you any kudos for opening a bank branch in downtown Seattle. Your kids, when you get home, are not gonna say, "Oh, Daddy, that was so, Mommy, that's so wonderful. You opened a bank branch and got more rich in downtown Seattle." But when we opened a home center with E-Trade Bank in Anacostia, that third world country, 10 minutes from the White House in Washington, D.C., we had 600 VIPs come to the grand opening in Anacostia. Marion Barry, the former mayor there, said, "I have never seen this many people under a tent in Anacostia in my entire public life, unless it was like a riot or something." But we had the Bush administration and three cabinet members. We had the mayor and three cabinet members of the district. We had Republicans and Democrats. Even Jack Kemp showed up in Anacostia. On a serious note, it was black, it was white, it was Republican, it was Democrat, it was conservative, it was liberal, and every media outlet in town covered it as front page news. When was the last time a bank branch on the news, unless it got robbed, you know? Do well and do good. You can do well by doing good. Am I at 5 minutes yet? All right, you gotta say something, brother. I'll talk.
I've been waiting.
Don't I sound like I'm preaching to you? So the thing we did with Homeland Security was just another example of an extension of this brand. I mean, this is the only thing we do that's not about poor people, it's about everybody. But you know, you look at America, again, a capitalist country, and when a disaster strikes, you have an emotional disaster, a physical disaster, and then an economic disaster. But where's the economic Red Cross? Doesn't exist. That's all we did was create the economic Red Cross. And Homeland Security is now our partner, and they've endorsed something I created called an Emergency Financial First Aid Kit, funded by the private sector, endorsed by the public sector, and made free to all of our clients. We serve 500,000 people now, and not one person pays a dime for our services. It's about a hand up and not a hand out. They've got to invest themselves. So at the end of the day now, we've now educated, and banking on our future is kind of like the thing I'm really passionate about, my legacy lever. We've educated 152,000 children, 35 kids at a time, in checking, savings, credit, investment, and the history of financial services, with 2,500 volunteer Hope Corps members, kind of an urban Peace Corps, to teach our children the first silver right. Because we're the largest capitalist country in the world, and listen to me now, no one's teaching our children life 101 skills. I'm not talking about rocket science. I'm not talking about something complicated. I'm talking about basics. And the number one cause of divorce in America is mother. More people filed for bankruptcy in 2002 than graduated from college. The bankruptcy rate has gone from 289,000 non-business bankruptcy filers in 1985 to 1.7 million last year. And the fastest group of bankruptcy filers, you, between 18 and 24. Now, let me give you a shocker. Unfortunately, those are not black and brown kids. Those are white college students getting a master's degree in psychology, an undergraduate degree in bankruptcy, paying for their pizza with a credit card, believe a check is a form of credit, and are calling home to you for more money. Ringing any bells? Ladies and gentlemen, we have an airborne crisis on our hands. We the largest economy in the world, and no one's teaching our children financial literacy. Yet we have a president, which I have supported as one policy, of an ownership society. I'm not suggesting it's the only policy I support, by the way. I'm a president with appointees, so I gotta say this right. We have a president that's supporting an ownership society, which, by the way, endows I agree with. But how do you put somebody into a home, but you can't keep them in a home unless they're financially literate? How do you expect us to manage our own Social Security account if we cannot manage our own checking account? Which is why on June 23rd, I am honored to say President Bush will meet with me and some of our success stories at Operation Hope to feature financial literacy for the first time by any president in the history of this country. So I want to wrap up, right? But I want to kind of give you a taste of the philosophy, a taste of the history, a taste of some of the partnerships. We now have 250 partners, and here's my five-year goal. We will fund $1 billion in low-wealth home ownership. We will educate 5 million children in financial literacy in this country. We will recruit 25,000 volunteers to teach our children financial literacy, because the last time I checked, teachers were married too, and most of them, unfortunately, are financially illiterate. So we need you to go in to teach in these classes, something that everybody can do to change somebody's life. We will spark a movement in this country by recruiting 1,000 companies to join our movement and to launch a civil rights movement in this country. Let me leave you with this thought. Let me assume that none of this resonated with you. That I'm an underwhelming speaker. I leave, you say, Jeff, come on, man. What were you thinking? Let's assume you got not blood running through your veins, but blue ink. And none of this spoke to you. And let me say this. You don't get any credit in this world for being a nice person. You don't get any credit from this world for being pleasant, for smiling. It takes 8 muscles to smile and 35 muscles to frown, but there are experts at being miserable. You don't get any credit for raising your children or being a good person like John Robinson. You're supposed to do those things. I remember the comedian Chris Rock once said, a guy walked up to him and said, I ain't never been to jail. He said, you're not supposed to go to jail. I mean, the guy wanted credit. You don't get credit for doing what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to help your neighbor. You're supposed to smile. You're supposed to be pleasant. You're supposed to pull over the side of the road if somebody has a flat tire and at least call somebody. You're supposed to raise your children. What you're supposed to do. You only get credit from God for helping other people. And I don't know about you, but I want a spiritual platinum card with no limit on it. Thank you very much.